upward instructions here. And I think they are helpful to us, actually, to try to look through a little bit of this and understand. So kind of, you know, some of these details, some of the details about like what the procedures were supposed to be to observe the Passover and so forth may seem a little less interesting. But if you actually kind of put yourself in the place of the Israelites and listen to this, it's pretty interesting what they're supposed to do. So chapter 12, would somebody read 1 to 13?
The Lord said to Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, "This month shall be for you the beginning of months. It shall be the first month of the year for you. Tell all the congregation of Israel that on the 10th day of this month, every man shall take a lamb according to their father's houses, a lamb for a household. And if the household is too small for the lamb, then he and his nearest neighbor shall take according to the number of persons, according to what each of you shall make your count for the lamb. Your lamb shall be without blemish, a male, a year old. You may take it from the sheep or from the goats, and you shall keep it until the 14th day of this month, when the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel shall kill their lambs at twilight. Then they shall take some of the blood and put it on the two doorposts and the lintel of the houses in which they eat it. They shall eat the flesh that night, roasted on the fire, with unleavened bread and bitter herbs they shall eat it. Do not eat any of it raw or boiled in water, but roasted, and its head and its legs and its inner part. And you shall let none of it remain until the morning. Anything that remains until the morning you shall burn. In this manner you shall eat it, with your belt fastened, your sandals on your feet, and your staff in your hand. And you shall eat it in haste. It is the Lord's Passover. For I will pass through the land of Egypt that night, and I will strike all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both man and beast, and on all the gods of Egypt I will execute judgment. I am the Lord. The blood shall be a sign for you on the houses where you are, and when I see the blood I will pass over you, and no plague will befall you to destroy you when I strike the land.
Okay, so here are the instructions for the people as to what they're supposed to do. Now he starts in verse 2. It seems to me, by recalibrating the calendar, he says, this month will be what? This will be the first month. Even their measuring of time depends on this great act of God in delivering them from Egyptian bondage. It's a new beginning. From now on, every time they look at the calendar, if they'll think about it, they're reminded of why it starts with the month it starts with. It's because of God's great deliverance from Egypt. So this is the start of a new way of reckoning time. This is your first month. If you ever forget when the Passover is, just look at it from that standpoint. It's always going to be in their first month. Now, their first month obviously does not correspond to our January. Their first month was essentially March, April, and through there. They had a lunar calendar and all that, so it kind of varies a little bit from ours. And what were they supposed to do? What was the first thing they were supposed to do in preparing for this Passover? Take a lamb. When were they supposed to take the lamb? On the 10th day of the month. When do they actually cook and eat the lamb? The 14th day. So they pick out the lamb and sort of, pen it up or quarantine it or whatever 4 days earlier. This is a process. This is not going to be a last minute hurry up choice. They've already on the 10th day picked out the right animal. And what unit of people is supposed to observe this? I mean, there's who is it that chooses a lamb? The household, the family. This is sort of a family event. And really, there's a good many times in the Old Testament where the family is sort of the unit of worship, of teaching and training and communicating the will of God. In this case, it's a family that chooses the lamb and they're going to eat it together. Now, sometimes you might have a family that was too small. You know, the lamb's going to be really big for them to eat. And so a couple of families would join together. That was okay as well. And he gives some specifications here. It needs to be an unblemished male, a year old. It can either be a sheep or a goat, although he generally speaks in terms of sheep. And on the 14th day, they all kill it at twilight. And what do they do with the blood? Yeah, essentially put it around the door. What do they eat that night besides the lamb? Unleavened bread and bitter herbs. Now, do you understand the idea of unleavened bread? What do we call leaven?
Yeast.
I bet most of you don't have the experience I have where you're, somebody in your family bakes bread every week. But yeast makes the bread rise. You know, you have a lump of like flour and oil and whatever you have. And it's just kind of a, you know, kind of a very, what would you say, dense consistency, kind of like cookie dough or something. But you got yeast in it. And so if you'll let it go for a few hours, it's really weird. That lump of dough just starts growing and growing. And it becomes kind of airy. You know, it's a lot lighter as it grows. And the process of making bread with yeast is a process that takes some time. When Sandra's going to make bread, she has to plan it ahead, because you can't just make it like that. You know, with hers, you have to feed the starter and then you make it and then it rises and then she shakes it in a loaf and it rises. And you know, it's like a day's process. So why unleavened bread for them? Exactly. It's the fact that when Pharaoh ejects them, they got to go. They don't have time to wait for the bread to rise and all that sort of thing. So eating unleavened bread every year at this time is going to remind them when they left. You know, unleavened bread. Unleavened bread would be to us like what? What would we call unleavened bread?
Crackers.
Yeah, crackers, basically. Crackers don't have leaven in them. So you know, they don't have that soft bread-like consistency. What about the bitter herbs? I wonder why they have that in this Passover feast. He doesn't ever really say, but I think I know.
Because the bitter thing that plague is going to be kind of bitter.
That could be. I'm also thinking even all the bitterness of the years of slavery. You know, that they're leaving, that may be something that they're reminded of as well. At any rate, that's what they do. They're to roast this lamb. They eat it all that night. They don't keep any till the next morning. They're to have their sandals on, their staff in their hand. They're all ready to go. And he says in verse 12, "For I will go through the land of Egypt on that night and will strike down all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both man and beast, and against all the gods of Egypt, I will execute judgments. I am the Lord." We've talked about that a little bit already, but here's the climax of the contest. God versus the gods of Egypt. Now look at Numbers chapter 33 and verse 4, and you see that idea again. Numbers 33, 4, kind of a review of this period. "While the Egyptians were burying all their firstborn, whom the Lord had struck down among them, the Lord had also executed judgments on their gods." So this is more than just God versus Pharaoh. This is God versus the gods of Egypt. Very powerful display of what the Lord could do. And everything as far as the Israelites were concerned depended on the blood on the house. If God saw the blood on the house, what did he do? He passed over. That's not, you know, we say the Passover, but I don't know if you think about it. God would pass through Egypt and he'd kill the firstborn and every house didn't have the blood. He saw the blood, he passed over the house, didn't come through it to kill the firstborn. And it's so interesting that what would happen to an Israelite family if they didn't put blood on the door? Same thing that happened to an Egyptian family. They lose their firstborn. It all depends on having the blood of the Lamb on the door. What happens to us before God in judgment if we don't have the blood of the Lamb on our soul? You know, it's the same parallel, all kinds of parallels between the Passover and our deliverance from bondage and sin. Comments and questions on this section here in chapter. Yes, Matthew.
When he says he's going to execute judgment on the Egyptian gods, is he speaking figuratively since they can't actually save their own people?
Yeah, well, yeah, I don't think he's saying that their gods really had reality. But they believed in their God, so what God was doing was showing them up and proving that he was superior to what really turns out not even to exist. Yeah. Justin.
Do we have any idea, like, how the killing of the firstborn, like, went about? Like, did they, like, see this happen and somebody actually did it? Or did they just die? Or was it, you know, very visible? Or
we'll be told a few things a little bit later on, but essentially, you know, they drop dead as far as we can see. We're going to say a little bit more about that when we come to that, though, so I'll save those remarks. Bill.
So God is telling the Israelites here just to put their clothes on. Why exactly?
Because they're going to leave. They got to be ready to go.
Right after this?
Yeah. Yeah, because they eat the Passover that night. Midnight, the firstborn of the Egyptians die, and Pharaoh orders them out. Michael.
I'd always assume this is a bunch of kids that died, but does this also mean the firstborn who has grown up and is now 50 dies as well?
I am not sure about that. I don't know if this is like the firstborn in every family unit, or if this would include parents who were firstborn. Anybody got a reason that would define that for sure?
Wasn't Pharaoh only the firstborn?
Probably, and he wasn't killed.
Yeah.
But I don't know that he always would be. Yes.
Wouldn't it just be Pharaoh was doing, you know, when Moses was born? What
the king's doing, he wants. Yeah, if you think about it that way, you know, they kill their males that were born, so perhaps it's the idea of in the family unit. Caleb.
Do you think the
bitter
bondage and the Christ parallels the
Maybe. I mean, you know, certainly a similar kind of thing, at least. And you take some time to think about it. I mean, most of you guys are not married. You know, those of you who are not married and are guys, how many of you are the firstborn? Can you imagine? Look around. You know, that'd be wild. You know, just to imagine, what if at midnight tonight, all those guys were gone? You know, and if we included firstborn adults, you know, firstborn married guys, that gets me too. So, you know, who knows? Yes?
Do we have an indication that they're just the male children?
I think so. In chapter 13, he's going to talk about how the firstborn pertain to the Lord, and say in chapter 13, 12, the males belong to the Lord. Every firstborn man, verse 13, you'll redeem. Verse 15, both the firstborn of man and the firstborn of beast. The fact that in the end of 15, every firstborn of my sons I redeem. The fact that the redemption of the firstborn seems to be firstborn males makes me think that that's what this destruction was the firstborn males. Other questions or comments? Yes, Jacob.
You see Christ instituting the Lord's Supper. There's fruit of the vine at the table. I'm going to see instructions for that here in the passage in chapter 12.
Correct. I don't think there are instructions related to that in the Passover information, unless there's something I'm not thinking about. So I think that would just been a part of the Jewish tradition for how they celebrated the Passover. Other comments or questions? Yes.
Is it only if the firstborn was a male, or is it the firstborn male.
I think it would have probably been the first male to be born, not just if the firstborn was a male. That would be my impression. Yes, Tim.
I was going to be like, you know, they were trying to say, well, let's go do our thing away from you guys because, you know, the sheep and things like that are abomination. And yet they're doing it in Egypt because they weren't allowed to go. And they're doing all these, well, essentially sacrifices right there.
Good point. Yes. Very good point. Other thoughts? Okay, so 14 to 20.
Now this day will be a memorial to you, and you shall celebrate and the feast of the Lord throughout your generation. Celebrate and determine ordinance. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread, but on the first day you shall remove leaven from your houses. For whoever eats anything leavened from the first day until the seventh day, that person shall be cut off of Israel. On the first day you shall have a holy assembly, and another holy assembly on the seventh day. No work at all shall be done on them except what must be eaten by every person that alone may be prepared to find it. You shall also observe the feast of unleavened bread, for on this very day I brought your host out of the land of Egypt. Therefore you shall observe this day throughout your generation as a permanent ordinance. In the first month, on the 14th day, on this month at evening, you shall eat unleavened bread until the 23rd day of the month at evening. 7 days there shall be no leaven found in your houses, but whoever eats what is leavened, that person shall be cut off from the congregation of Israel, whether he is an alien or a native of the land. You shall not eat anything leavened in all your dwellings. You shall eat unleavened bread.
So this is the instruction for the continuation of the feast of unleavened bread. It's going to be a 7-day feast following the Passover, a time in which they will not eat anything leavened during that whole time. If you like leavened bread, you'd have been out of luck for a week. But it reminds them then of this time, of this Passover event. You know, we're not going to make this just a one-day thing. This is going to be a whole week thing. They're not even allowed to keep leaven in their houses. No possibility of accidentally using leaven inappropriately. Comments and questions on this? Dan?
So the expulsion of leaven is more than just a practical thing. But it's also a thing to remind them, is that what you're saying?
Well, I think the whole feast is really a memorial feast reminding them of their leaving Egypt, of God delivering them from Egypt. Now, it becomes a sort of a symbol and type of the deliverance God gives us. Because God has delivered us from our bondage, we have Christ as our Passover lamb, and we are to be observing the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And the point Paul makes about that in 1 Corinthians 5 is, we should have already gotten rid of the leaven of sin out of our lives, just like they were supposed to get rid of the leaven of bread out of their houses, because the Passover lamb, Jesus, has already been slain. So there's a ton of parallels, some of which are picked up on in the New Testament, to try to teach us the spiritual application with our spiritual deliverance. Yes, Seth?
In verse 19, when it says that they'll be cut off from Israel, whether he's a stranger or a native of the land, is the native of the land talking about the Israelites?
Yeah, I think so.
Because they're not natives to the land where they're going, but
it will come to be considered their land. Yes, so I think he's saying, you know, whether it's a foreigner that's just living among the Israelites or whether it's a native Israelite. That's my understanding.
I just think it's so cool that even before they get in the land, they're considering themselves natives.
Exactly. It's their land. God has promised it to them. Yeah, good point. Other thoughts? Joe?
Going back to the comment about all of these things being a reminder for what has been taking place. Deuteronomy 16, the bread is called the bread of affliction, which I think also goes to the New Testament spiritual point of getting rid of the
the yeast or the leaven, remembering that Egypt represents sin, how we can get rid of that, we ought to see that as affliction.
Good point. Yeah. Good comment. Michael.
Back to the, about the alien in the land, it's interesting that an alien, I don't know if you mean proselyte there or just somebody else there on business or...
Yeah, I think just, yeah, strange and foreigners that were living among them.
Yeah, and how that person is expected to live by their rules.
Yes.
And so many times, you know, some of us have more worldly friends than others, but we live by their rules sometimes, and that's not the way it should be.
Excellent point. Yes, because there were many things in which the foreigners that were living among the Israelites were expected to follow many of the laws and rules. Now, some things they couldn't participate in, but they were expected to conform themselves to the Israelite moral code in many ways. Okay? 21 to 28.
Moses called for all the elders of Israel and said to them, go and take yourselves lambs according to your families to slay the Passover lamb. You shall take a bunch of hyssop and dip it in blood, which is in the basin, and apply some of the blood that is in the basin to the lintels of the two doorposts. None of you shall go outside the door of this house until morning. For the Lord will pass through and smite the Egyptian whenever he sees the blood on the lintels and on the doorposts. The Lord will pass over the door and will not allow the destroyer to come into your houses and smite you. And you shall observe this event as an ordinance for you and for your children forever. When you enter the land which the Lord will give you, he has promised. That is promised, you shall observe this right. And when your children say to you, what does this right mean to you? You shall say, it is the Passover sacrifice to the Lord, who passed over the houses and the sons of Israel in Egypt, when he smote the Egyptians and spared our home. And the people bowed low and worshiped. And the sons of Israel went and did so, just as the Lord has commanded Moses and Aaron, so they did.
Okay, so Moses tells them, go do this. Time for you to act. Take the lambs and do what I've told you to do. Now the part of this that I want you to pay special attention to is how he says this is to be the pattern for you even when you enter the land. You're going to go through this rite, this Passover unleavened bread period. And your children, they will ask you, why are we doing this? What does this mean? And this will give you an opportunity to tell about how the Lord passed over the houses of the Israelites in Egypt when he smote the Egyptians, but he spared our homes. Part of the purpose of God in having this annual celebration was for the parents to be able to teach their children what this really means, why we're doing this. That's something you see so much in the Old Testament, is the concept of the parents teaching the children the great things God has done. How are children going to know that? Well, God wants godly parents to teach and train and instruct their children. Here's what happened. Here's what God did. And that way their children can be impressed by the greatness of God. You know, was God going to have a Passover deliverance every generation? It wasn't going to be that. God had one deliverance from Egypt that he wanted them to continue to remember and be taught by and be impressed with the greatness and the wisdom of God. And so that's what you've got going right here. Comments? Michael.
It is interesting that applies today to those of us who are parents. You know that that your everybody's kid at some point tries to go for the grape juice or the crackers. And it's a really great opportunity to tell them, even at a very young age, you know, the gist of what's going on, and they will understand as a teacher.
Absolutely. Yeah. They want to know, and it's your opportunity. And it's your opportunity to teach it right. What should we say to our children when they ask about the bread and the grape juice?
What the Bible says.
Yeah. Wonder what that would be. Let me give you an illustration of what we might say. And see if you can see the flaw in this. You know, what if we say, well, look, this is what God commands us to do. This is one of the acts of worship that we're supposed to do. And every first day of the week, we're supposed to take some unleavened bread and we're supposed to eat it. And we're supposed to take some grape juice and we're supposed to drink it. And that's what God tells us to do. And we need to make sure we do it reverently and all that. And we make sure we do it every first day of the week. And so we teach our children about the Lord's Supper. Do you see a problem with that?
It falls short, doesn't tell them a bit of the meaning behind it.
Yes, exactly. What should I be emphasizing as I tell them what it means? Yes, this is Jesus. This is God delivering us from our sins. This is Him sacrificing Himself so that He could release us from our prison and bring us into fellowship with Him and all of that. So often what we want to focus on is the rules God gives us, but not the reason. So when we focus on just what we're supposed to do, we focus on ourselves and not on the Lord. We have to be careful about that. You know, it's amazing to me how we do in the Lord's Supper. I've been in churches where when we get ready to partake of the Lord's Supper, it seems like all we remember is how often we're supposed to do it. I've been in churches that when we partake of the Lord's Supper, it seems like all we remember is how we're supposed to do it. And I've been in churches that when we partake of the Lord's Supper, what we remember is the sacrifice of Christ and the deliverance that He brought. That's much more edifying. It's not that we don't need to be concerned about how to partake of it. It's that that's not the main focus. You know, let's do that. But let's focus primarily on the great deliverance God gave. We become so man-centered when all we think about is the rules for how to do it, instead of understanding why we've got those rules, and it's because of the great sacrifice Jesus gave for us. That's what we need to teach our children. Teach them the great things the Lord has done. Justin.
I think we got to be careful when we're talking to our denominational friends. I think sometimes I tend to be the same way. I kind of try to not go into full detail of actually why we're doing it, but just say, and not necessarily with just the Lord's Supper, but with a lot of problems that denominational people have with us and what we have with them, you know, the hot topics, I guess you could say. Sometimes we're a little bit too shy and don't put enough detail into it, and we just say, well, we just do this because of this, and we don't actually, you know, because we don't want to create a wave or create confrontation or we're scared about that kind of thing. We don't need to be that way.
Yeah, we need to teach the whole plan of God. You know, sometimes we really short circuit that in what we say. Carl.
Same thing when we're teaching friends or our children, encouraging one another. When we understand the why behind what we're doing, doing it the right way, we'll want to do it the right way if we grasp the meaning.
That's exactly right. You know, we talk about the importance of reverence and remembering the Lord's death. Well, if we're really reflecting on what the Lord has done, that's exactly what we'll do. You know, that makes perfect sense. But if we're just doing it as a rule without understanding the reason, we're probably not going to be very successful even in keeping the rule. Other thoughts? Ben.
With this, is right there, Bryson, they have painted the doorpost whenever they practice this whole ritual with it just eating the lamb. That makes sense, in the land.
I believe just eating the lamb. As far as I know, they didn't continue to put the blood on the door. Am I right about that? That's what I assume. Yes, Kristen.
I don't know if I picked this up could the Egyptians be saved by putting blood on their doorposts? Or were they all destined to have their firstborn killed no matter what?
Good question. I don't think the Egyptians were even given these instructions. So I don't think they had that option. Logan.
Just as far as if they put the blood on the doorpost from then on, it says in verse 24 after Moses is given the instructions to Aaron for the blood on the doorpost, you shall observe and write the statute for you and your sons forever. So could that be referring to the blood on the doorpost?
Could be, but I don't think so. Yes, Andrew.
What is the significance of using hyssop to apply the blood? And is there any connection between that and what David says in Psalm 51 about purifying with hyssop?
There may be, and there's hyssop used even to get that drink to Jesus. I'm not sure about the symbolism of all that, but the hyssop was sort of like a sponge that just applies it. It's kind of like, you know, they didn't have spray bottles, so you got to have some kind of a paintbrush or whatever. I think that's the function of it, but the symbolism I'm not so sure about. There probably is something in all that, but I haven't worked all that out. So. Carl.
In terms of the sacrifices, once the temple had been established, wouldn't these have taken place there and not in the family homes anyway? This wouldn't have been something where they'd been doing this away from the temple. To be putting blood on their own doors unless they took it with them from the temple.
They did do this in Jerusalem, but they did it in their homes and not just collectively in the temple.
That's what slaughtering the animal?
I don't know about the slaughtering of the animal, but eating of the Passover. Yes, Kate.
Do you think there's any significance in that they didn't like the blood on, but they were commanded to strike on?
Well, let's see. What have we got here on how they put it on? He says to, put it on. Where's the passage that talks about the hyssop? I don't even. 22. Yeah. Take a bunch of hyssop and dip it in the blood, which is in the basin. Apply some of the blood in the New American Standard. I think the idea of the hyssop would be the idea of being like a sponge, or essentially like a paintbrush, where they would more or less paint it on. Yeah, I don't think it's like they sprinkle it. I think it's like they contact it to the door. Yes, Bill. Yeah, the question was the sacrificing of the animal, but yes, go ahead.
Okay, so would that be disobeying God, or? Because they're not doing it at home, or was that not necessarily instructed to do it that exact way?
Yeah, good questions. I think the question is, they did at least partake of it in their home. We see Jesus and the disciples doing that in the last Passover in Matthew 26. When, once God established the one place where his name would dwell, and that was Jerusalem, then all the sacrifices were to be done at the temple and not anywhere else. But I'm not sure how to resolve all that. If somebody got that worked out and know exactly how we ought to look at all that, I'm not sure about that. Michael?
Is there something about that even as soon as we're born into more detail?
I don't think so. I don't think, if I'm understanding your question, I don't think when they established the tabernacle that it was wrong for them to offer sacrifices in other places.
No. Okay. Are there more details concerning the Passover in all the laws given?
I don't think so. At least not in Exodus. Yes, Lainey.
Is the destroyer in verse 23 the same destroyer as number 2 in 1 Corinthians 10 when it talks about what killed them in the wilderness?
It may be, it's not the same destruction. The destroyer is just a way of talking about the agent of God that goes through and destroys. I think we're probably talking about a messenger God sent through, like an angel, to kill. I don't know if it was the same angel, but it's the same concept that God sends someone to destroy. Yes, sir.
Did they, sprinkle the blood on the doorpost to keep the destroyer out or to remember the Passover?
Well, initially, this is so that their home will be protected and God won't kill the firstborn. Then the Passover every year reminded them of this event. Good questions. Good discussion. Yes, David.
Is there any I was just going to point out, it was said in verse 27, it says that the people bowed low and worship. And it said that in 431 before God gave deliverance. I thought that was interesting how they were humble before. And then, you know, they had that doubt in chapter 5. And then, you know, once this is fully played out, once again, they bow low and worship.
Hey, good point. Both at the beginning and the end of this whole section, they bow low and worship. Good point. And verse 28, they did just what God said. Kind of a rare moment for the Israelites. But after observing these plagues, I think that was a very smart idea. Joe.
Just in 2 Chronicles 35 with Josiah observing the Passover, I think that indicates that they were sacrificed in the sanctuary.
Okay, thank you for that. Yes, Tim.
It's kind of rare for them to actually do this in the future. I mean, it's like always a big deal when they kind of pass them like in the kids. I mean, do you presume that like it was basically kind of hit or miss?
Well, there were times that they apparently hadn't been doing it and they start doing it again. You see Hezekiah's Passover, Josiah's Passover, and so forth. There were times throughout their history when they didn't seem to have much concern about keeping the rules or about even doing some of these ceremonies. So, all right, 29 to 41.
Now it came about at midnight that the Lord struck all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sat on his throne to the firstborn of the captive who was in the dungeon, and all the firstborn of the cattle. Pharaoh arose in the night, he and all his servants and all the Egyptians, and there was a great cry in Egypt, for there was no home where there was not someone dead. Then he called for Moses and Aaron at night and said, "Rise up, get out from among my people, both you and the sons of Israel, and go worship the Lord, as you have said. Take both your flocks and your herds, as you have said, and go, and bless me also." The Egyptians urged the people to send them out of the land in haste, but they said, "We will be dead." So the people took their dough before it was leavened, with their kneading bowls, bound up in the clothes on their shoulders. Now the sons of Israel had done according to the word of Moses, for they had requested from the Egyptians articles of silver and articles of gold and clothing. And the Lord had given the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, so that they let them have their request. Thus they plundered the Egyptians. Now the sons of Israel journeyed from Ramses to Succoth, about 600,000 men on foot, aside from children. A mixed multitude also went up with them, along with flocks and herds, a very large number of livestock. They baked the dough which they had brought out of Egypt into cakes of unleavened bread, for it had not become leavened, since they were driven out of Egypt and could not delay, nor had they prepared any provisions for themselves. Now the time that the sons of Israel lived in Egypt was 430 years. At the end of the 430 years, to the very day, all the host of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt.
So about midnight, the Lord strikes all the firstborn. Now, I am guessing that the people had heard what Moses had told Pharaoh, and maybe even what he told the Israelites, and the people were knowing about the threat to the firstborn. So I'm imagining, I don't know for sure that this was true, but if it were us and we had some sort of information about that, we'd be setting the alarm and waking up every hour and checking on the family and on the kids and, you know, things like this. So you can imagine what a horror there was when at midnight in every household there's a dead child. Wow, that would have huge impact. And it's hard to imagine what that felt like to them. And really, even in Israelite houses, there was something dead too. But in their houses, it was the lamb and not the first one. And there's this great cry. Does that remind you of anything? What had the Israelites been doing because of the oppression? They had cried out. Now it's the Egyptians crying out. Because there was no home where there was not someone dead. And what does Pharaoh do?
Tell Moses to get out.
Yeah. No qualifications, no limitations, no conditions. He begs him to leave. And to leave with everything. The family, the flocks, the herds, the whole nine yards. And he asks them to have the God whose very existence he questioned to bless him to. Who won in the God versus Pharaoh bout? You know, this is a totally one-sided victory. Pharaoh ends up totally capitulating. And they go out. The Egyptians urge them to leave quick. They say, we'll all be dead. And they request all these presents that the Egyptians gladly give them. It looks to me like this is almost a way of paying them for their 400 years of slavery. You know, so they get all these things from the Egyptians and they leave. 600,000 men. Lots of folks leaving. Remember God's promises to Abraham? What had God said that we looked at yesterday? They multiply. How many of them were there that went down to Egypt? 70. Now 600,000 men plus the rest leaving. I'd say the Lord did a right good job of fulfilling that promise. That's a lot of people, you know, leaving. And how long have they been in Egypt? 430 years. Now that fits with what God had told Abraham back in Genesis 15 and verse 13. He said they'll be enslaved and oppressed 400 years. So 430 years for some of the time, part of the time that they were there, they were not oppressed until the new Pharaoh arose. So roughly 400 years of oppression, total of 430 years that they spent in Egypt. There is one complicating factor in this date of 430 years. And that is in the book of Galatians, chapter 3, where the law came 430 years. It's Galatians 3:17. The law came 430 years after the promises. But I am assuming we're talking about in Galatians, the promises as they were repeated to Jacob when he went down to Egypt in Genesis 46 and 47. So I take it that it was 430 years that they were in Egypt, most of that time in bondage. And I will say that, you know, several different ways of trying to kind of figure out dates in the Old Testament. We have a real hard time correlating early events in Bible history with historical events that we know the dates of from history. As we come later in Bible history, we've got more information, both biblically and outside the Bible, to correlate dates. And so this statement that they were in Egypt for 430 years kind of helps us in locating some dates that gives us some framework. Let me show you one other dating verse that's helpful, not about girls and guys dating, but chronological. I can't help you with the other. 1 Kings 6:1. Now it came about in the 480th year after the sons of Israel came out of the land of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel, in the month of Zib, which is in the second month, that he began to build the house of the Lord. So what you've got, and this really does give us a lot of information. You've got 480 years from the Exodus to the beginning of the temple under Solomon. And you've got 430 years from the time they went into Egypt until the Exodus. So 430 plus 480 gives us a lot more information than we would have otherwise had. We know that the temple started to be built. The date I often see is 966. And if you add 910 to that, I think we would have them going into Egypt, 1876, a round figure, obviously, and the date of the Exodus, about 1446, something like that. Again, there's a lot of, you know, things that we might question as far as a year or two or even 10, but essentially that's what we seem to know from these passages. So that might help a little bit just in some sort of a chronological framework. Well, the main point here is they left, and they left with Pharaoh's blessing and encouragement, and the encouragement of the Egyptians, and God proved himself over Pharaoh and the Egyptian gods. Comments and questions, Daniel?
This is probably irrelevant, but if God told Abraham to be 400 years, why does it say, it says 430 years, but it makes a point to say it's to the day. So if God hadn't told Abraham about 430 years, why did it say, why is it like the exact thing, like to the very day, 430 instead of 400?
Well, I think the 400 was rounded and was the period of oppression. When they first went down there, they weren't oppressed. So maybe 30 years that they weren't oppressed. I suspect the 400 is a round number anyway. Sometimes you got round numbers, sometimes you got specific ones. Here he seems to really want us to know this is exactly 430 years. Michael?
Mine says literally, it happened on this day.
And there is a question mark about that, if it's trying to say exactly 430 years, or if that to this day needs to be interpreted in a different way. Either way, 430. And that's not a very round number. If we take that as a round number, we're probably saying, you know, 425, 435, whatever. Yes, Ben.
Please, Nick. It's going to hold upon us this thing God had promised Moses, I will make you as God to Pharaoh. And as they leave, Pharaoh asks Moses, bless me. You know, this man who claimed to be God is asking Moses, the guy who was living out, you know, in the wilderness, to bless him.
Yes. Really turned the tables on things here. Good point, Carl.
I love the great irony that all this plunder eventually is going to be in the temple of God as the items of worship for God.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, a lot of what they took to build the tabernacle and all of that. Jody.
In 38, where it says the mixed multitude also went up with them, does that mean that some of the Egyptians left with them?
Yes, I think so. Or some other nationalities, but it wasn't all Israelites. I think so.
Well, they just
I think some others wanted to accompany them, wanted to leave as well, and join with them. Yes. Josh.
It's interesting to see, I guess, see everything turn, as we've been pointing out, on Pharaoh. In this chapter, verse 32, you see the flocks that he didn't want them to take. In chapter 10, come back, he's like, here, you can have the flocks too.
Yes, it's amazing, isn't it? Andrew.
It's amazing, really, to think that God told Moses that he'll keep his promise, and they went through all this and they went through all the hardship, and didn't God do what he said? What makes us think that since he kept his promise then, what makes us think that he'll turn his back on us? He said that he's making us a promise today that we'll have eternal life held in his arms, if we do, everlasting arms, if we do what he says. And if he can do it here,
God's a reliable God. He keeps his promises, and he's proven himself. Yes. Patrick.
In verse 32, and Pharaoh says, bless me also, is he saying bless me by leaving, or does he have the audacity to say, while you're there, give a blessing to me?
I think the latter.
Okay.
I think he's actually asking for a blessing from the Lord through Moses.
Okay.
Yeah. Kind of ironic and kind of amazing, but I think he is feeling overwhelmed by this. He's kind of come to believe in God. You know, I mean, why wouldn't you after all this, Michael?
God made a pretty spectacular display of it here, but it's a natural thing when we read about the difference between light and darkness, that when God is in the presence, what happens to the darkness? side that it just, you know, it gets destroyed here, and the life is blessed. And it's interesting to see that that happening through Jesus when he comes to live among men. What happens to the people in darkness compared to the people in light?
Good point. All right, 42 to 51.
It was a night of watching by the Lord to bring them out of the land of Egypt. So this same night is a night of watching kept to the Lord by all the people of Israel throughout their generations. And the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, "This is the statute of the Passover. No foreigner shall eat of it, but every slave that is bought for money may eat of it after you have circumcised him. No foreigner or hired servant may eat of it. It shall be eaten in one house. You shall not take any of the flesh outside the house, and you shall not break any of its bones. All the congregation of Israel shall keep it. If a stranger shall sojourn with you and will keep the Passover to the Lord, let all his males be circumcised. Then he may come near and keep it. He shall be as a native of the land, but no uncircumcised person shall eat of it. There shall be one law for the native and for the stranger who sojourns among you." All the people of Israel did just as the Lord commanded Moses and Aaron. And on that very day, the Lord brought the people of Israel out of the land of Egypt by their hosts.
Okay, so he has the rules on who can and can't eat the Passover. Not foreigners, not sojourners or hired servants, but circumcised slaves, yes. They eat it in a house, and they are not to break any bone of it in verse 46. Does that remind you of anything? Jesus in John 19:36, no bone of his was broken. I believe that's the parallel. That Jesus is our Passover lamb, so no bone was broken. You've also got a passage in Psalm 34, but I really think the stronger connection is with this lamb, that no bone was to be broken. But no uncircumcised person can eat of it. Only those who are in this covenant with God. And so that's what they do. So what you've got is, in this whole chapter, you've got both instructions and the actual carrying out of these in terms of the Passover and their Exodus. Comments and questions? Yes, Mason.
Is there, do you think, besides just there being a parallel between broken bone, what was the significance between that? Is there, no, the lamb isn't struggling against it, Christ isn't struggling against it?
Maybe the idea of the lamb that sacrificed is whole.
Yeah.
Other thoughts? Logan?
When it says no foreigner shall eat of it, when proselytes have been excluded from that, would they have been counted as Jews and taken the Passover?
Well, verse 48, if a stranger sojourns with you and celebrates the Passover to the Lord, let all his males be circumcised, and let them come near to celebrate it. He shall be like a native of the land. So the proselyte, who's, that means someone who's circumcised, could partake of it as a native Jew. Michael?
And that's different from 12:19, where the aliens were commanded to eat. That's the feast that follows.
Yeah, couldn't eat of leaven, but if they're an alien and not a proselyte, they can't partake of the leaven. Yes, Jonathan?
On to Peter comments, maybe a practical question that we encounter sometimes today, the connection between the Passover and the Lord's Supper. How much of the Passover is a precedent for our order of the Lord's Supper in this situation? In our assembly sometimes, someone will come in who is not a Christian, someone who's not connected with us as the children of God, and they want to partake of it just to, you know, for them to perform the ritual to make them feel like they worship. How forceful should we or should we not be in seeing through it that a foreigner, someone who's not a Christian, is there?
That is a good question. I don't know that I have an awesome answer to that. Obviously, that's a question that historically has been debated a lot, the open and closed communion and all that sort of thing. It perhaps, you know, I would make a couple of observations. One is, it is somewhat more concrete whether someone has been proselyted than whether someone is truly a Christian. Because our service to God is more of something that involves our heart that only God knows for sure. I mean, I imagine that in many churches there are several people who really aren't Christians who are accepted as members. And the point that's made in 1 Corinthians 11, perhaps, I wouldn't say this too forcefully because this might be an extension of the application that's not valid, but he encourages us to examine ourselves and to partake of it. Now, of course, the point primarily is you guys need to really be, you know, verifying that you're partaking properly. But I'm not sure that there's any procedure, at least in the New Testament, for us to be policing you can or you can't. You know, I certainly would not encourage someone who was not a Christian to partake. You know, it wouldn't be something where we ought to just say, well, go ahead, it's not going to hurt anything. But I don't know that we are supposed to, stand vigil and try to make sure that only those who are in the covenant do partake. So I guess the absence of some statement in the New Testament that gives us policing powers would make me think that each person is going to have to decide for themselves if they believe they're in a covenant with God. I don't know if somebody's got a better answer. Joe?
Would we make the same sort of requirements with singing? Congregational singing? We don't exclude non-Christians from partaking of that.
I suppose if I was going to play devil's advocate, I'd say I don't know that there were any rules in the Old Testament on who could sing to them. But there were on particular passage.
But we don't have either rule in the New Testament. Would be like
okay. Fair point.
Yeah. Just again, you already indicated this, but we're not supposed to be in the business of hard reading. We can't
do that.
So it's the whole policing that is a lost cause.
Right. Roger.
Does this keep an emphasis on they obeying what the Lord says, even that they're in verse 50, like they did exactly what the Lord says? Would that just be a contrast to later on them not obeying? It's almost like as soon as they saw the signs and the plagues were there, they were obedient, but then when they kind of like got a little further away from the signs and the miracles, they were more rebellious?
Yeah, I mean, their obedience has been highly inconsistent. I don't know what else to say than that, because they're not very far away from a lot of signs and wonders, even in the wilderness. A lot of things the Lord does, and yet many times they don't obey. It's kind of like we are, sometimes very inconsistent in our obedience. Other thoughts or comments? Okay, chapter 13. There are some further instructions that are important.